Hi, you're watching Stefan Levera podcast, brought to you by Swan.com. So I just got back from Madeira. This is an autonomous zone off of Portugal, and there was a huge conference there, Bitcoin Atlantis 2024. So I had a great time there, and while I was there, I caught a few interviews, and so we're going to put those together into an episode for you. And so there's a range of speakers, Lynn Alden, James Lavish, Thomas Strohlite, Peter Todd, Francis Pouliot, and Stephen Roos. There will also be timestamps, so for those of you watching on YouTube or on X, or various platforms, you should be able to click ahead and see the different interviews. And so that'll give you a nice range of perspectives there. So with that, on to the interviews. Hey guys, so we're back here at Bitcoin Atlantis. I'm here with Lynn Alden, great macro analyst and obviously really into Bitcoin and obviously doing her part to help educate people about Bitcoin. Now, Lynn, I know you had a great meme recently, which was the classic mid-curve meme. And on the grug brain side, the left curve and the right curve, the galaxy brain, were both Bitcoin, and the mid-curve, the mid-wit, was macro. I'd love for you to elaborate a bit. What are you getting at here?
When I say that as a macro person, it's kind of the joke, but basically, everybody who's not holding Bitcoin over the past several years is underperforming people that have been holding Bitcoin. And so there's all these really smart people that are like, if you do this, you can capture 200 basis points and then convert it to this asset and make this spread happen. And it's like really hard, grinding work. And then just literally people that just hold Bitcoin, and it just goes up over the long arc of time faster than what they're doing. Yeah. And I think that people are overthinking Bitcoin in many ways, like that mid-curve part where they're like, oh, well, what about this? Or what about this? Or what about this? And it's like, the cool thing about Bitcoin is at the end of the day, there are people that are like, sound money, hard to confiscate, hard to resist it. Like, I want to own some. That's kind of like the left curve. It's not hard. Then the right curve, you can get into all the technical details. You can get into all like the macro stuff about why Bitcoin is powerful, what it's solving. But people get caught up in the middle, and they're still trying to do all these little arbitrage trades or just not looking into Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is just, it's a cleaner solution to a lot of things that they're already trying to do.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right, because really so many people, for example, financial advisors will kind of all be talking about their typical 60-40 stocks and bonds, or maybe there's someone who's really into property and they're trying to get some, you know, they're working so hard, and you think how many channels there are where they're talking about, oh, here's how you flip property, or here's how you get passive income. But then, as you were just saying, like, you can just hodl Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, 100% allocation doesn't make sense for everyone, right? But, and you know, I'm quite bullish on Bitcoin. I do hold other assets, but it's funny, the amount of time I spend on those other assets compared to the returns I get from them, compared to, you know, the amount of time I spend on Bitcoin and returns and kind of, you know, just appreciation I get from that is just two different worlds. And so I think that having a Bitcoin slice in your portfolio just smooths a lot of things out. And you can still put your time or energy or other resources in whatever you want, but it just makes it all easier. That's what good money should do.
Yeah. I'd love to turn a little bit to some of the conversations around reserve currencies, reserve assets, and people are talking now about how the US dollar is sort of, are we going into a multipolar world? And another common theory people talk about is Brent Johnson, aka Santiago Capital's theory about the dollar milkshake theory, right? Obviously, you know that very well. His basic idea is this idea that as people, you know, as the system has a sustained deleveraging event, we would basically see the dollar or DXY, the index, pump really hard before it's finally replaced by something else, whether that's Bitcoin or maybe in his view he thinks it might be gold. I'm curious your view. Do you agree or disagree, or how would you explain it differently?
I think there are basically two things that are working at the same time. So one is the existing dollar network. And all the debt that's denominated in dollars is reinforcing that network. That all represents inflexible demand for dollars, which to his point, you know, whenever there's a dollar shortage, people scramble for dollars or they risk defaulting. And so there's a very strong bid for the base unit of account that most debt is denominated in, which is the dollar. And there are countries gradually trying to de-dollarize. They're holding less of their reserves in dollars. They're holding it either in more illiquid assets, maybe investments, for example, infrastructure, commodity deposits, things like that. And that around the margin is happening. The hard part is it's very hard for these countries to fully de-dollarize, because let's say, for example, Russia and India want to trade with each other, and they want to go around the dollars. Russia's selling oil to India. India's giving them a lot of rupees. Russia eventually accumulates a lot of rupees, and they don't know what to do with all those rupees. So the U.S. is special because it has the really big capital markets. You can reinvest a lot into it. It's very liquid. It's, you know, very diverse. Whereas a lot of other markets, they accumulate too much, and then they have all these different bilateral trade agreements. They don't have the depths of capital markets. Even the euro, as a shared currency, doesn't really have a shared capital market. So they don't have shared debt markets or shared stock markets. And so it's actually, there's less liquidity, less depth of capital available there. So that's the network effect that's really hard for these other countries to recreate. I think over time, they're chipping away little by little, but it's a very long process, and it's going up against that dollar network. The other factor is now stablecoins, because even as at the top level, a lot of people are trying to de-dollarize. At the bottom level, that's not really the case yet. You'll see, you know, the central bank's trying to de-dollarize, and the black market for currency in that country is still heavily dollar-based, and stablecoins are another tool to get them there more easily than physical dollars. So I think that that all is reinforcing the existing dollar effect. And so I'm less in the dollar milkshake camp, because generally whenever the dollar starts to rise, something breaks and it feeds back into U.S. markets. And the main effect there is that because the U.S. has run such structural trade deficits for so long, the rest of the world has reinvested those dollars into owning U.S. assets. And so whenever there's a dollar shortage, those parts of the world start to sell their U.S. assets. Could be treasuries, could be stocks, could be other things like that. They start to cause a liquidity problem. And that's what triggers the Fed to say, okay, stop selling our stuff. We'll do swap lines. We'll print more base layer money. And so the feedback loops are getting tighter and tighter and tighter as that imbalance keeps growing. And so I think that, yeah, during times of credit stress, you'll see a dollar spike. I'm less in the camp that you're going to see a gigantic dollar spike, but I am in the camp that it's going to take quite a while to displace the network effect that is the dollar, largely because of all that global debt that's tied to it.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's a great way to explain it. So I guess if we're thinking base money, people look at, let's say, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. What are the assets on there? And of course, the physical cash and coin, right? That's what we're talking about when we talk about base money, or M0. And so Matthew Mishinskis has some really interesting work on this, where he's sort of saying, I think recently he was saying, Bitcoin is already number 7, and I think we might have just pipped 6 as well. I've just beaten the UK pound in terms of base money. Like, if you compare Bitcoin versus gold versus all the others, it's already, I think, 6th or 5th in the world. And so I guess, would you say it's just a process of more people learning to save with Bitcoin? Is that kind of the simple grug brain answer?
I think so. That's really the wise left curve view, is just more people hodl, right? I think that there's a natural incentive for people to want to hodl. People, if you just come up to people in the street and would say, would you like to hold a currency that's growing at 20% supply per year, 5% supply per year, 1% supply per year, trending towards zero, which one would you rather hold, assuming they were all of similar speeds and convenience? You'd want the one that's not inflating away. And so I think it's a learning process. There's frictions, you know, there's tax things, there's technical things to learn about. There's a million cryptos grabbing their attention, and JPEGs and things like that. So it takes time to filter through and find the signal. But I think, yeah, and over time, once the light clicks and they figure it out, it's so powerful that they generally want to share it, right? So they don't just become Bitcoin holders, they often become Bitcoin advocates. And then they go try to tell their friends, and maybe it doesn't work the first time, but then when Bitcoin doesn't die again and it has another pump and number go up and all these kind of basic stuff, those people come to them and say, hey, remember that Bitcoin thing? I actually want to learn more. And so I think, yeah, over time, just the network effect builds. And, you know, my colleague Jeff Booth often says, as long as Bitcoin remains decentralized and secure, then XYZ, right? So it's like, as long as there's no tail risk that can otherwise be some sort of kill shot against Bitcoin, I think it's just going to keep accumulating monetary energy and go up that ranking in terms of competing with other base monies. And even if it surpasses the U.S. dollar and gold in base money, it still has a while to go, because when you look at all of the global bond market tied to dollars and all the global M2 tied to dollars, that's still part of the overall network effect that represents demand. And so there's still numbers ahead. There's like another zero, basically, ahead of it.
That's a really great point, because as you said, and this again comes into like, what asset are people going to use? Because ultimately, there are businesses. There's a ton of businesses right now who, businesses or even high net worth individuals who keep some of their savings in US government debt in bonds. And so it's really about that process of them shifting out of that. And obviously, I think, you know, the ETFs and all this stuff, BlackRock and, you know, BlackRock organizing seminars to promote it as well. I'm curious, are you starting to see or hear of these conversations at higher levels yourself, or in terms of like maybe the work, the advocacy work you're doing? Are you starting to see and hear, you know, high level or high net worth people or large institutions get involved?
Yeah, I think we're certainly seeing that. My book was kind of written so that it's palatable to people at that level. It kind of has them as one of the target audiences. Not the only target audience, but it's something that a CEO can give to his other CEO friends, for example. And that's happened a number of times. Large CIOs or CEOs share the book. That's one example. But even outside of my book, just the education that's spreading over time is working its way up to the system. And you know, a key point is that institutions are made of people. And it, you know, for the past 5+ years, most of those big institutions have people working there that are Bitcoiners. And they just don't have the critical mass to convince enough of their organization. But one thing is, and I keep stressing this point, most people in the world have not seen the Bitcoin logarithmic price chart. They've not seen the higher highs, higher lows, higher lies, and that kind of repeated pattern. Most of us have in the echo chamber. And so instead, what people see is only the prices that they remember. So every time they look at the linear chart, if they even look at the linear chart at all, which still most people probably have not, it always looks like it's in a bubble or a dead bubble every single time. And when they see the 2017 bubble and then the collapse, and then they see the 2020 bubble and then the collapse, if they see a third rise, it kind of wakes up. It's like, wait, this thing is not dying. I keep thinking it's dead. It's not dying. When people, not just that there has been three or four resurrections, but when they've actually seen three resurrections, that's where I think a lot of things start to change. And especially those higher levels, they're seeing that. They're saying this asset's not going away. It's getting to a macro scale as a $1 trillion market cap. The liquidity is there. There's you know, regulatory clarity because that matters for institutions. I think you're seeing more and more normalization of it as an asset to hold, at least as a slice of a portfolio. Maybe they're not full on maxis yet, but they say, well, if this is increasingly becoming an asset that we want to have a non-zero position in, and when you have hundreds of trillions of capital that starts incrementally doing that, every 1% is a Bitcoin market cap, like what it is now. So I think that is slowly catching on.
Fantastic. Well, everyone check out Lynn's work. I'm subscribed to her newsletter as well, so go and check it out. I'll put the links in description. Lynn, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm here with James Lavish from the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. We're here at Bitcoin Atlantis. So, James, let's get started. I know you're also the author of The Informationist, a great newsletter, so guys, check that out. So, James, let's kind of get a bit of your take on where things are with, you know, U.S. government debt. We've spoken a bit about this. I know it's one of our, you know, the hobby horse issues for you and just in general. So let's just talk a little bit about that issue. I mean, it looks like the government debt has gone from, what, 33 trillion to 34 trillion in the blink of an eye.
In a nanosecond. So, yeah, I mean, the problem is, Stefan, is that we are now adding just about $100 trillion of debt to the overall, government debt every 100 days.
So, 100 billion.
100 billion
yeah.
every day.
Yeah.
Sorry, the numbers are so big.
Yeah.
I've spoken too many times today.
Yeah.
So $100 billion every 100 days. So if you think about it, we're the U.S. collects about $4.9 trillion in taxes annually. And we're carrying over $34 trillion of debt. And so now we're adding another $100 billion every 100 days. So this is like an individual, like a person who is making $100,000 a year, is carrying $5 million of debt, and is adding $140,000 of that every 90 days, every 3 months. It's just mental.
And no bank would give you that kind of credit if you were an individual, right?
No line of credit for that. That's right. So, that's the issue. And it's unsustainable. Everybody knows it. And even Jerome Powell admitted to it on 60 Minutes just a few weeks ago when asked, like, what about the debt? Are you worried about the debt? And he admitted, he said, look, I don't work for the Treasury. I can't tell them. I mean, I work for the Treasury. I work for the government. I can't tell them what to do. And he said, but it is unsustainable.
Yeah.
It's unsustainable.
So obviously this is bringing up the whole question like dollar milkshake theory and what comes next and multipolar world and all these kind of ideas. I think, you know, there's two different ways you could argue, right? Like you could go like Brent Johnson, Santiago Capital, will say, look, the dollar is the least dirty shirt in the, you know, in the in the laundry. But another view would just be like, look, it's going to go multipolar, and maybe people, there'll just be less people buying U.S. government bonds altogether, and they'll just choose other assets. Now, of course, we would love them to choose Bitcoin, but you know, maybe businesses will just hold less U.S. government debt, and instead they might hold, you know, physical property or some other country's bonds or something else. I'm curious, where do you stand on this?
Well, look, I mean, it's no secret again that the government needs to issue a ton of debt because we operate in a perpetual deficit. We have to issue more debt to cover the old debt. So as debt matures, we have to issue new debt to pay that off. So everybody knows this. And we're borrowing more than we're making. So we have to issue more debt every year, another $2 to $3 trillion every year. And so it's no secret that there will be a wave, a massive wave, and eventually a tsunami of debt that comes at us. So if you're an investor and you hold long-term debt, your issue is that it's not just that there's irregular inflation. It's that we will hit periods, and like Luke Roman talks about this, and I think Lynn Alden talks about this, but I expect us to hit periods of high inflation. We already have structural inflation, but we may get super high inflation for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. And we're talking about 12, 15, 18, 20%. Not the 2 to 3 to 5% that they admit to, but real inflation that reaches these levels. So if you're a business and you've got cash on your balance sheet and you're all excited because you're making 4 or 5% in a money market and or in T-bills for a little while, that's all great. But when the real inflation rate jumps to 12, 15, 20%, that's a loss of 7, 10, 15% of purchasing power for you every year. And so what do you want to do? You want to hold an asset that stores that value. And that clear asset for us, at least, is Bitcoin. And it's a clear store of value for long periods of time.
Yeah. So I think a really interesting point I've seen recently is Matthew Mazinskas has been speaking about this idea of base money, right? And he spoke about recently how Bitcoin had just hit 7th in the base money sort of, if you count just on base money, like central bank money or central bank reserves, and I believe even recently might have just pipped the UK as well, so it would now be 6th counting gold. So gold at the top and then the others, and then, you know, Bitcoin is already up there. So I'm curious how that plays in, this concept of base money as contrasted with, you know, other ways of, you know, counting inflation. And let me just put the point this way. So the way I've seen him point it out is, since 1969, the US base money has expanded at about 9% per year. And since 2008, that number is actually closer to 11% per year. So obviously, as you were just saying, if you're a stock investor, if you're a bond investor, and you are, you know, not making more than 11%, you're losing money, aren't you?
That's right. So, and if you go back to, I believe, 1971, it started about 7% per year. It's about 7% per year. So it's clearly been going up, right? So, that's your challenge. Your challenge is, how do you keep up with that base that inflation? The base money is, it's being devalued. And so it's being debased, literally. And why are they doing that? They're doing that so they can pay back those bonds with cheaper dollars, with cheaper pound. And we saw it. So go back to the UK last year, 1 year ago this fall, when they ran into the gilt crisis. Well, what was going on there? The problem is, there's so much debt in the system that and we had been running at 0% interest rates for so long that the pension funds in the UK knew that they had these liabilities that were forward liabilities that they have to cover. So when pensioners retire, they have to pay out a certain amount to them. And they know they've got to pay out that amount. Well, how do they keep up with that inflation when you have zero interest rates? What they were doing is they were putting leverage on the safest trade that they could, which is the gilt in the country. They would leverage those trades 2-to-1, 3-to-1. And then when the interest rates moved, it blew them up, and they went insolvent. They literally were going insolvent until the UK stepped in, the Bank of England stepped in and rescued them. Yeah. So
on that topic, let's talk a little bit about some of these various programs, right? And I know you detail some of these on your newsletter, things like BTFP and so on. Some of these are programs that I think, to quote Lynn Alden, they sort of loosen for the government, but they tighten for the everyday private sector. So I'm curious your view, are they just going to keep coming out with new programs and new programs, or they just keep extending these programs, or what do you see as likely possibilities there?
Super likely, almost a certainty that they have to. And so the Treasury needs to keep people, they need to keep companies and banks solvent. They need to have enough liquidity in the system to buy these treasuries. There's no choice. They must. So they come up with a BTFP program so they have enough liquidity to keep going. What's going to happen next? Well, you've got the reverse repo market, which started with over $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion of capital in it, of money. And now it's been drawn all the way down to somewhere between $500 and $600 billion. So that's all that's left. What's happening is that is buying all those short-term T-bills, because the money markets are in the reverse repo and they can buy T-bills instead, so at a little bit better rate. But that's about to expire, meaning it's about to be dried up. Once that's dried up, then the Treasury has to turn to longer dated treasuries to start to take money out of the bank reserves, because they can hold treasuries. But once those bank reserves get down to $2.5 trillion, then it becomes a big red flag for the Fed and the Treasury that they've got to have new programs to make sure that they shore up the liquidity, because you can't have a Treasury auction fail. You must keep them liquid. And so what they do is that the first thing they're going to do is when the reverse repo market is dried up, when the BTFP program, when that matures, expires, what they've been doing is they've been talking about this new rule that's going to force banks to use the overnight window, the discount window. And traditionally, Stefan, that had a negative connotation to it. If you use that window as a bank, it meant that you were illiquid and that you were running into problems. It would be like an individual using a super high rate credit card because they had no other choice. But they're making it a requirement for every single bank who wants to have access to that capital to use it at least once every year. So what are they doing? They're taking that negative stigma off it. They're opening that up for and making it a part of normal practice, which is there's nothing normal about it to have to borrow money from the government.
Yeah. So definitely something to keep an eye on. Let's turn a little bit to the Bitcoin world. In terms of Bitcoin industry, Bitcoin companies, is there any interesting trends you're seeing from that perspective, things that you want to highlight there?
As we see Bitcoin, the ETFs take hold, and we're seeing about $500 million come into that and into those ETFs every single day. It's just reinforcing this growth of Bitcoin. And what's happening is it's forcing institutional investors to do the work and to understand Bitcoin, because you can't be an institution and not own any while your competitor does. It's a simple, extremely simple analysis just to look at whether you own Bitcoin in your portfolio versus a 60-40 portfolio. And if you own just 3%, it magnifies your returns to a level that you just can't ignore. So it's forcing them to do the work, it's forcing them to understand it. What is that gonna do for us here? Well, we're very US-centric, obviously. United States investors, they think of Bitcoin as a store of value primarily. And so, but as they learn about this as a store of value, they go down that rabbit hole, as you and I have done, and they see what the use case is for it around the world. When you have 1.5 billion people in the world who are unbanked, they recognize the fact that this decentralized protocol that can be on anybody's phone, and Bitcoin can actually be used as money. then that's where the new investment comes, and these companies that are making all the Lightning companies and the wallet companies and the software companies on individuals' phones, like these are big deals. And what we're seeing is that interest to inject capital into those projects, into that infrastructure, and to build the ecosystem. And that's exactly what we're doing over at our fund.
Great. Okay, well, let's leave it there. Listeners, will put James's links in the description. Check out The Informationist and the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. Thank you, James.
Thank you so much, Stefan. See you next time.
Back to the show in a moment. The lead sponsor of this show is Swan Bitcoin. Over at swan.com, using the website or the application on your smartphone, you can buy Bitcoin and you can also learn about Bitcoin. Swan puts out a range of material that makes it easy for people to learn about Bitcoin. So notably, there is a Welcome to Bitcoin course over at swan.com/welcome. Now, when you're ready to buy Bitcoin, Swan makes it easy for you. You can either do an ACH transfer in or you can do a wire transfer in. And then you can either do an instant buy a lump sum amount of Bitcoin, or you can set up a recurring savings or Bitcoin purchase plan. And so this is a great way to get started with stacking sats, and meanwhile you're learning about Bitcoin so that you are knowing a bit more about what you're buying and you are ideally saving into. Now, Swan has a range of different service lines. There's also Swan Private for high net worth individuals or for companies or for people buying over $100,000 worth of Bitcoin. Check out swanprivate.com. So there's a range of different services. You can find out more over at swan.com. This show is also brought to you by mempool.space. Mempool.space is the leading Bitcoin and blockchain visualizer. I use it all the time because I want to keep an eye on what's happening in Bitcoin's mempool. With mempool.space, you can use the mempool goggles and you can see what's going on in terms of what transactions are coming through in the mempool, whether that is RBF enabled or multi-sig or single signature. There's all kinds of different things that you can view and explore there. And of course, the headline feature of mempool.space is that you can use it to target the fee for your transaction. Now, they also have a transaction accelerator program. And so if you want to get on the wait list for that, go to mempool.space/accelerator. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back at Bitcoin Atlantis. I'm here with my friend Thomas Strohlite. He is also the editor-in-chief over at swan.com. Thomas, let's get some of your reactions. Yesterday, Michael Saylor had a great talk here talking about Bitcoin is for everyone. Now, some people would say, no, it's not for everybody, or maybe it's not for you just yet. Yeah. Whereas Michael had a different framing. I'm curious if you have any reactions on that.
Yeah, it's always interesting for me to watch Michael Saylor's journey. No one knows his personal journey, but the journey of what he's communicating to the public. And this was a much more spiritual description than anything before. He's talked about what a great asset is, what a great investment Bitcoin is. And he went in two dimensions that I hadn't really seen him go in before. One was in Bitcoin being for everyone as an investment. And he didn't just talk about companies putting it on their balance sheet. He talked about families and families being able to preserve their values, their family businesses with Bitcoin. He talked about not-for-profits. He talked about lots of other things. But that family connection, that spiritual connection was there. And he didn't just talk about Bitcoin as a great investment for these things. He went into the spiritual component of Bitcoin, perhaps not as spiritual as some of my writings about Bitcoin, but he definitely talked about how people go through a spiritual journey of realizing how sound money changes them, and they eventually start from being a skeptic and eventually become an advocate. I would use the word zealot in some cases, but becoming advocates for Bitcoin. And the really nice way that he tied up the presentation in saying Bitcoin is for everyone, he really talked about how the more people who participate in Bitcoin and the more people who advocate for Bitcoin, the more people become Bitcoiners. And this is how Bitcoin becomes for everyone ultimately. So, yeah, I know there are people who say Bitcoin is for anyone, but not necessarily for everyone. But in the long enough time frame, I think Bitcoin will be for everyone. It'll just be so obvious and so nonsensical to not choose Bitcoin. But we're in that transition, and he rightly pointed out educating other people and being patient with them and not telling them to, you know, not just insulting them and telling them to have fun staying poor is really the direction to go in. And again, there is so much momentum, and I felt a lot of hope again during his presentation about where Bitcoin is headed. And you know, it's not that we won't have our challenges, but we keep knocking down major milestone after major milestone, and the acceptance, you know, like Bitcoin is for Wall Street now. Bitcoin. Bitcoin.
Wall Street loves Bitcoin.
Yeah, and most people who are longtime OGs, or many of them, will have discovered Bitcoin at Occupy Wall Street, at an anti-Wall Street rally. So the fact that Wall Street's actually come around without the Occupy Wall Street movement, this to me is one of the most powerful things. Like Occupy Wall Street, Bitcoin is a protest against everything that's wrong with the traditions of this world. Except it's not a protest that goes to Wall Street and sits there and then runs out of energy or can get hosed away by the police. Bitcoin is a decentralized, distributed protest. I run a node in my house. You run one in yours, presumably. I'm not saying you do, but you know, there's tens of thousands of people who are protesting by running a node, and we don't go to the government so that they can wash us away with a hose. They have to come to us if they want, and they have to come to many of us in countries where they're not the government. So stopping this protest is practically impossible, and it's a much more effective protest in the long run than carrying placards around. You're actually protesting with economic power. You're protesting by opting out of the system, and you're protesting without making it convenient for the government to wash you away. So it's really remarkable how far we've come now that Wall Street's occupying Bitcoin.
One other topic I want to get into with you is around, and obviously this is relevant for both of us as people who are writing and speaking about Bitcoin, is analogies in Bitcoin. Because there, and sometimes this is an area where people criticize Michael Saylor as well, but sometimes people say, oh, you're using this analogy and that's not correct, or that's not technically accurate. Yeah. But at the same time, how useful are those analogies? Even if they're not 100% technically precise, can they be like a training wheels for people? And obviously you write a lot of stuff around Bitcoin as well. And I'm curious your thoughts on using analogies to get people over the line, let's say.
Yeah, I think analogies are how we often learn about things. We say this is like that in this ways, and it's different than that in those ways. So that's the best you can do. And in the digital realm, I think there have been many Bitcoin writers who've pointed this out. In the digital realm, we analogize everything. When we say there's windows on your computer, so they're not real windows that you open and close. They don't keep the wind out, but they are. They are square, see-through lenses that you can move around. Again, you can't move around windows in your house, but the analogy works, right? And there's a trash bin on your desktop. And so we better interact with this digital world that is nothing but ones and zeros through analogies and through concretization of things. And so these analogies can be very helpful, and they're especially helpful in Bitcoin. The idea of digital gold is far from perfect, but if you know a lot of things about gold, then you can apply many of those things to Bitcoin, just as one example. And I think these analogies keep getting reinvented and pushed forward more and more as we better understand what Bitcoin is.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to defend it because, of course, like maybe you could argue it's not literally energy or it's not literally digital gold, but is that helpful for somebody to at least get an idea and get started? And I think that's what you were sort of getting at there as well. Any other things in terms of stuff you're working on, any articles or things you're kind of excited about right now?
Sure. There's nothing that's fundamentally new that's big. I'm always working on articles, nothing huge that's hit. I am working with a guy named Bevan Waite, who goes by Bit Intelligence on YouTube, which is a video adaptation of my essay, The Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto, which is my most popular essay, and there's a film festival here tomorrow. We're sharing a 5-minute clip of it, and we hope to release the full film before the halving. So it'll be something that we'll broadcast, I'm sure, on the Swan YouTube channel and get it going. And I'm doing a lot more. I find I've been writing for a few years now. I wrote really prolifically in the early days, and a few things were really sticky and had powerful messages. And those messages haven't been distributed. There's so many as widely as they could be, as widely as they beneficially could be. So I'm doing a lot more revisiting of some of the more powerful ideas that I've written about. So I've done a few podcasts here, and I've tried to focus on different of those. But so if people are watching here, I'd say if you haven't yet watched Bitcoin is Generated generational wealth. Watch that. If you haven't yet read The Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto, read that. And I have a whole collection of articles called Who Are the Bitcoiners, which includes articles like Rich or Poor Bitcoiners Have What Money Can't Buy, Don't Tell Me There Are No Heroes in Bitcoin, and Bitcoiners Are Not Toxic, They Have Integrity. And those I think are the biggest ideas that I've kind of shown a light on in my writing that is unique. And they will help people better understand what it means to choose to be in Bitcoin, and why, if they're experiencing all of these spiritual experiences, these emotional experiences with Bitcoin. I've written in detail about that.
Right. Great. Well, we'll put the links there in the description, but make sure to check out Terma's writings over at the Swan blog, and of course, the Bitcoin is Generational Wealth. Terma, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Stefan.
Hey guys, we're here at Bitcoin Atlantis with Francis Pouliot. He's the founder and CEO of Bull Bitcoin. Just gave a talk. If you wouldn't mind, just give a few high-level ideas on what your focus is. Obviously, you're really trying to do non-custodial, right? Do you want to just spell out just a little bit on that?
Yeah, so the main point that I was trying to convey in my talk is that I've been trying to build a non-custodial Lightning Network wallet, which suits a very specific use case, which is I want people to be able to immediately download the wallet, open it up, and be able to receive $100 worth of Lightning without requiring any sort of custodian. And I've been working on this for about a year, tried to integrate. I worked on LDK, I worked on the Breeze SDK, and I came to the conclusion that the LSP model, where you're getting an LSP to open a channel with you, that's how you as a mobile end user are going to get inbound liquidity. It just doesn't work. The economics are not there. There is a systematic problem or issue with Lightning, which is the way that the network has been designed. And no matter how much UX improvement or app improvement we build on it, that problem is still there. So I was ultimately not able to create the product that I wanted to build self-custodially, and it's not for lack of trying.
Yeah, and as you were pointing out, it's not just an app thing, it's also like an economic incentive thing, that even if you pre-buy the liquidity, as you pointed out, that you, if you had like a million users with, you know, X amount of money, the LSPs are going to have to have like a lock up $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, which is, you know, just crazy level of money. And so then you were sort of talking about, you know, acceptable zones for, you know, trade-off, let's say. And some may view this as like a sliding in the, oh, you're backing off on the non-custodial. And you were saying, well, basically liquid because of the 11 of 15 multisig and potentially federated Chaumian mints if they're distributed, right? That was kind of the idea you're getting at. I'm curious if your thought on this is like, would you be open to like soft forks, as we were talking about, you know, off camera earlier, would that be something interesting to you, or is it more like, no, we've got to, you know, find other things before going to that?
It's a good question. I just assume that soft forks will not happen, just as a conservative fallback, right? So I have a product, I have clients, like at the moment I can't count on a future potential soft fork, so I have to find solutions that already exist. And that's part of the reason why I'm a user and believer in the Liquid network. It's because it does exist right now and it's usable at the moment, but I am not aware of any even soft fork proposal that solved this issue with Lightning. Even timeout trees, and I mean, I haven't been following it that closely, but as far as I know, there's no solution to the economic incentive problem of Lightning liquidity. There might be, I don't know, you're probably, because you interview a bunch of people.
As a quick example, I mean, I'm not saying I'm shilling for this, but as an example, Arc has no inbound liquidity problem because the ASP. Now, you're pushing the liquidity onto the ASPs, but that could be potentially something where the ASP deals with that, but not the end user. So maybe there's something there, but it's still a bit unclear, right?
But again, And I don't know Arc more than having read a little bit about it when it came out. You're still going to have to lock up massive amounts of liquidity, right?
At the ASP level.
Yeah, at the ASP level. And sure, that's always going to be possible, but how much is it going to cost?
Yeah, that's a fair point. So then, if you know, as you said, you're kind of dealing in the world today, and you need answers now. And so, I guess that's where I guess the other point that you know the obvious question, and I asked you off camera as well, is Liquid will also hit a limit too. And so, do you have an answer there? Is it just raise the Liquid block size or what?
Yeah. So Liquid is very centralized, and it's not a decentralized blockchain by any stretch of the imagination. It's orders of magnitude more decentralized than like Wallet of Satoshi, but it's also orders of magnitude less decentralized than Bitcoin. So Liquid has a block size limit. If Liquid becomes so popular that their fees are starting to rise on Liquid, we will just raise the block size on Liquid. I don't see any reason why the Federation wouldn't do that. The Federation currently doesn't make any money, right? It's been running for 7 years. It doesn't make any money. None of the functionaries make any money. The fees that are collected by Liquid are barely enough to cover the Bitcoin network fees when the Federation is doing payouts. So what that shows me is that there are people who are willing to bear costs to running a Federation without needing a financial incentive. Like, for example, what is the incentive of Bull Bitcoin to build on Liquid and to promote the Liquid network? I'm not collecting any fees from it. It's because I need something to exist for me to transact with my users. So I'm sure a lot of the Liquid functionaries are in the same boat where they want Liquid to exist, period, and they're willing to pay for that to happen. So it's not like if we raise the block size, there's going to be this like the same problem in Bitcoin, for example, is okay. It's like we want the fees in Bitcoin to rise so that there is a financial incentive for the miners. Whereas in Liquid, I don't think there's a financial incentive for the functionaries with the fees. So we can raise the block size. You know, Liquid has dropped the fees. The Liquid Federation has decided to bring the minimum to 0.1 sat per byte instead of 1 sat per byte. The Liquid Federation also very recently decided to put like a 8x fee discount on confidential transactions. So, and these are decisions that are being made by a very small amount of custodians. And so, yeah, we'll just raise the block size.
Yeah. So I guess the main criticism I could think of is that people would just say, look, you can't scale a blockchain with another blockchain. It's just going to hit limits. And, you know, you're relying on somebody to sort of, because you got to think about sustainability, right? Like, are these businesses just going to keep funding it, right? Like, are all the functionaries, are they profitable in some other business venture that they're willing to subsidize and keep running the Liquid Federation, even with a raised block size?
No, that's a very good point. So, when you're looking at how to evaluate these custodians, one of the criteria that I was talking about in my talk is like long-term sustainability, right? So for people always talk about nation state, and I also like to point out that Bitcoin still exists. Bitcoin works perfectly fine. I don't think we need to scale the first Bitcoin layer. It's just going to be expensive, right? So fees are going to be like, I don't know, 50 to 100 bucks, 200 bucks over the next decade. So at least for the foreseeable future in my business, I'll always be able to fall back on the main chain, and that's super decentralized, and that's perfectly fine. You can't scale the decentralized blockchain with another decentralized blockchain, but I don't see why you cannot scale a form of payments using Bitcoin as a unit of account with a centralized blockchain. The main risk to Liquid, I think you nailed it, it's a disinterest of the Liquid Federation. So for example, everybody knows that Liquid is powered by Blockstream. Blockstream doesn't control Liquid, but Blockstream acts as a IT support company for, you know, they're paying for all the development of most of this. I mean, Bull Bitcoin is also paying for its own kind of like Liquid libraries, but when we talk about like the functionary software or the a lot of the core infrastructure, like the HSMs that the Liquid Federation members, functionaries are using, that's all finance and supported by Blockstream. If Blockstream was to go away from one day to the next, like, you know, they're all hit by a comet or something, the Liquid Federation would still work, definitely for a while. But at some point, it might degrade because
someone
would have to step in. I don't know how much it costs to do all that, but it's presumably expensive. So is there an incentive for the functionaries? I mean, as I mentioned before, like the incentive is that there is a payment mechanism. I think the incentive for a Liquid functionary is like, I need some kind of custodial bearer asset for my user, but I don't want to be a full custodian of this, right? So this is definitely like the bull Bitcoin idea. Like I need some kind of custody compromise, but I don't want to be the one who's the custodian, and Liquid just fits the bill. I'm not sure if Fedi has the same scalability issues as Liquid. I think from a technical perspective, Fedi is probably a lot more scalable because it doesn't have a blockchain. And as far as I know, like the mint doesn't really do much other than, you know, mint, but it has the same, you know, kind of a governance and incentive issues, right? So let's say that a bunch of Bitcoin companies decide to do a 3 of 5 Fedi Mint Federation, and they're probably not going to be making too much money off of that. I mean, how are they going to be making money, actually? Are they going to be charging transaction fees within the mint? Are they going to be gateways and charging fees to convert mint coins to Lightning? I mean, there's presumably an open market and a very low barrier to entry, so their fees are probably going to trend very low. I don't think it's gonna be financially viable. But these companies probably have the same philosophy as Bull Bitcoin, where they want their end user to be able to use some kind of eCash token. So they're going to be maintaining this Fedi Mint just because they want it to exist.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. Maybe it's like you treat it like a loss leader, like you just pay to keep that thing running so that your users have a way out. I think these are very fair points, but I guess we'll have to just see. But thanks for joining us. Listeners, check out Francis's work over at Bull Bitcoin, and thanks for joining me, Francis.
Can I add a minute? Yeah. I would like for people to check out the Aqua Wallet. So what Samson and Gen3 have done, this is a really good example of what I'm talking about, which is the user is holding a custodial bearer asset, LBTC, and every time they're making a Lightning Network payment, it's a swap in and swap out using the Bolt API. Bull Bitcoin has actually been working on this for quite a while. We built a Bolt Trust library, which is, I believe, going to be kind of like the reference client for Bolts. We built Dart bindings. We built Dart bindings for Liquid Network web wallet. I've heard other people that are working on the same kind of technology. So you know, if you are a Rust developer or Dart developer, we have like 4 open source projects that we're working on right now. So we're looking for contributors. And otherwise, if you're interested in contributing, I would definitely recommend checking out Fedi Mint. Fedi Mint. One of the reasons why Fedi Mint is interesting is that they do have a lot of funding, kind of like Blockstream had. So it's not a project that's likely to just go away. So Liquid and Fedi Mint, if you're trying to, you know, do Bitcoin payments, I would check those out.
Yeah, okay. I guess one other question, just while we're here, if the idea is, like, I use Fedi Mints, I mean, are you concerned about the rugging, right? Like, do you think that there'll be Fedi Mints where people just get rugged?
Absolutely. That's so a lot of people I've been talking to have accepted that self-custody for small amounts is not going to be possible. Pure self-custody. This is not a controversial topic, at least like in the private conversations that I'm having with people who like know their shit, you know, people who are running exchanges, running wallets, running non-custodial wallets as well. The question is, what is the custodial model going to look like? And some people that I know, they're advocating for a kind of free banking model where you're going to have 100,000 eCash single order mints where people are Uncle Jimming for their friends and families. And I think this is going to lead to an incredible amount of rug pulls, right? And the kind of theory of free banking is like, well, after so many people keep getting rugged by their mint, there's going to be some kind of like mint rating agency, and you know, there's going to be free market competition, and there's going to be exchange rates between different mints based on how reliable and secure they are. I mean, I don't think this is a really good outcome personally. I think like having very strong, maybe not just one like Liquid Federation, but having like a small amount of very, very well-run federations. Okay, another point on this. I'm very involved in the Bitcoin Jungle Project. The Bitcoin Jungle Project is a nonprofit, so I don't have like an official title there, but I'm part of it, right? So I have some insight about what it takes to run a custodian. Bitcoin Jungle is essentially Uncle Jimming for all its users in Costa Rica. You need to have one individual, because it's a Lightning node, right? So regardless of whether you have a multisig for like the cold storage funds of that custodian, if you're using Lightning, like the funds are on a server. You know what I mean? So and the server is accessible by one person. Okay, so you need to find one individual which is extremely skilled, like proficient, because you can screw up with Lightning and lose everyone's funds, that is honest, that is not incentivized to rug. For example, someone that's independently wealthy, or someone that it's not tempted. Someone that's like has time, that's committed to the long term, has a sense of morality. It's like it's not easy to find someone who's like skilled and not incentivized and a good person. That's what it takes to be an Uncle Jim at a level of more than like your friends and family. And this is like really, really hard. People are underestimating how hard it is to run a custodian. Not only am I afraid of custodians rugging people, and also, you know, people think about like, oh, we're going to get tribal elders and like village mayors like custodying the funds, and because they're incentivized, they're not incentivized not to rug because people know where they live and that kind of stuff. I'm like, no, man, people will screw their neighbor over. Like, that's, I don't know, like, they'll move to another country and they'll screw people over. So like, very, very few people can resist the temptation of not screwing over their neighbor if they have the opportunity, especially if they have a plausible deniability that they just like accidentally lost the funds. I'm also worried about accidental rug pulling. Like, it's really easy to like lose a backup. Like, we know this, right? You can run a lightning node and lose your backup. It's not easy. There's also like hacker honeypot. There's government censorship. So if you want to avoid government censorship and like 6102 events, you need to have anonymous custodians. But if you have anonymous custodians, then you don't have that accountability. So the person is might not be attackable by the government, but also he can rug everybody that he's custodying for, and he's not going to get caught. So it's not easy, right? So I'm more of a believer in very strong, well-maintained, well-run federation. So running a single custodian is hard. Running the federation is also very hard. So Blockstream is not only financing like the software development of this, but there's a lot of like internal governance. I was on the Liquid Oversight Committee for years, which is like a non-profit role where like I talk to the Federation members and functionaries and developers, and I kind of like give my opinion on how things should evolve. And I have some insight, and there's a lot of effort that's being put into developing these kind of like bylaws, I would call them. For example, what happens if a functionary decides to quit? Which is another problem with custodians, like you can't quit, right?
So I guess there's like this dino fed idea, you can swap out the functionary, that kind of thing. Similar, maybe with Fedimint, you can roll the guardian over or something.
Yeah, so I know that Fedimint wants to do that, but then it's something that's possible, but then you need to have, okay, so the other federation members needs to choose someone else to replace that. How are they going to choose it? How are they going to communicate? Is it a vote? Is it a majority? What kind of a majority are we talking about here? So these are like things that are very, very tricky to pull off. So although I think like Uncle Jimming is good, but this is not something that... This is not something that a group of friends are going to be able to pull off for like their classmates, like in a way that's secure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Look, I mean, it is challenging, but let's see what people figure out. So, thanks for joining me, Francis.
My pleasure.
Back to the show in a moment. CoinKite.com make the best Bitcoin security hardware. They have been in the game for a long time, and they are leaders in the Bitcoin security industry. So the Cold Card is a great device. I use it as part of various setups. It's ultra secure, it's very reliable, and crucially, you don't have to phone home to set it up. You can just plug it into the wall, or you can plug it into your laptop or your PC if you're a beginner, and you can set up and sign up and create a new Bitcoin wallet without having to phone home. So that's a really cool feature. I really appreciate that. And it has a range of different features that come with the Cold Card. You can use Juris pins, BrickMe pins, you can use multi-signature, you can use single signature, you can use Seed XOR. There's just a range of options that you can learn about and use all as part of your Bitcoin security setup. So if you want to get your Cold Card, try it out with Sparrow Wallet or Spectre Desktop or Electrum, and get yours over at coinkite.com using code Lavera for a discount. And now, back to the show.
Hi guys, we're back at Bitcoin Atlantis. I'm here with Stephen Roos. He is was previously at Blockstream. You might have seen him on the previous episode we did together. So we're just going to have a bit of a chat. Let's talk a little bit about, let's start with sort of some of your views around the broader sort of layer two space. So a lot of people rely on this idea of the definition of unilateral exit, right? Like this idea that you must be able to exit. Obviously Lightning gives you this. You could argue state chains maybe is in that category, but it's sort of, you may be a bit debatable. Obviously I think Arc would fit in this category as well, and I know you're working on Arc as well. So do you want to just talk a little bit about just sort of high level where you see layer twos going?
Yeah, so the unilateral exit, I mean, I think by now everyone agrees that a real layer two is a layer two that gives you a unilateral way to get your money back on the chain without needing participation from any third party. But the way you get your money back is always like relying on mempool, relying on the on-chain dynamics. And since Lightning got there, like the mempool policy became a really crucial part of the infrastructure of Bitcoin. Because before that, people just send their transaction in the mempool and eventually it will get confirmed. But if you have like different transactions being dependent on each other and then people competing to get competing transactions in, mempool policy becomes really important. And mempool policy is actually crucial for the security of things like Lightning. State chains probably lesser so, even though I don't know how they are currently implementing state chains. But for Arc, it's the same. Like in Arc, if you would have a competing unilateral exit with someone trying to cheat you, you also rely a lot on like mempool policy and fee structures. And on the other hand, you also have the cost of going back on chain, right? If you have a Lightning channel and you have transactions or HLCs that have really small amounts, but your on-chain transaction to get that amount uncheated from you is going to cost you more than the amount, how much do you actually own that HLC? And with Arc, it actually is multiples of that worse, where if your entire VTXO exit strategy can rely on a series of like maybe up to 10, 11 transactions on-chain, and if they each cost you $5 or $10, you're... Yeah. Do you really own the money if you can't get it back for less money than what it is?
At like an economical level, I guess, what we're saying, right? And there's a lot of technical complexity, right? There are some people like John Carvalho, as an example, would argue maybe Lightning is the maximum complexity that we should be working with. I mean, that's his argument. I'm not, obviously, you might disagree with that because Arc is maybe a bit more complex.
I disagree with that.
Yeah, I presume you do, right? But anyway, I would also like to chat with you a bit about MEV. So this concept of miner extractable value, obviously, it is a problem over in shitcoin land, in ETH. Yeah. And there are people who have a concern about, as an example, things like Drive Chain or other ideas, or potentially Opcat with CS CheckSig from Stack could potentially enable a Drive Chain and therefore, you know, MEV as well. Mm-hmm. So I guess some people view it as like maybe MEV is inevitable, but let's at least not encourage it. I guess maybe that's the way they would frame it. How would you frame it? Is it a problem for Bitcoin, or, you know, how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I think first of all, if you look at Ethereum, like that's where MEV is really big and where it's like a really big problem and where it comes from kind of as a research space. Ethereum is very different from Bitcoin. Like in Ethereum, you make your transaction and your transaction is basically like a function call or something. You say, I want to do this, but you don't know the state at which this function is going to be executed. So depending on the actual state of your transaction, the outcome of the transaction can be wildly different. And you don't know upfront what the outcome of your transaction will be. And that means that someone who has the ability to reorder different transactions and make them like actually execute on a different state by changing the state maybe from underneath what the spender was trying to do with this transaction, you can have wildly different outcomes, and you can actually like extract value by people trading and wanting to do certain trades, but then not actually doing the trades they want to do. And Bitcoin is vastly different from that, because in Bitcoin, there is no state. Like, the state is your UTXO you're spending, and you actually commit to the UTXO you're spending in your transaction. So if that state changed, your transaction is no longer valid. So you cannot have this, like, even if your transaction is executed on a different state, it's still valid, but it has a different effect. In Bitcoin, that's not possible. It does change when you have things like APO. Because if you have APO, you no longer commit to the state, the previous state of the smart contract, quote unquote. And then MEV starts to become a possibility. But I think it's still like vastly on a lower scale than Ethereum, because we don't have this like whole large state things. But if you're going to have covenants where, for example, with Matt, Merkleized all the things, they're trying to store some state in like contracts. And then you can have more complex contracts with states, and then different transactions can actually hook into different states without knowing the state. I think when we're building covenants, we will find ways to commit to the previous state so that we can avoid most of the MEV. I think it's also possible we can eventually end up with contracts where we can have MEV. But personally, I feel like the imminent fear people have from it is a bit overstated, because just the model of Bitcoin is so vastly different than the part of Ethereum that actually makes MEV the problem.
I see. And as I understand. Part of it is because Ethereum has what you know they try to have as these decentralized markets, and because of that, there's all this incentive to try to front run, and that's where this MEV part comes in. Because if you are the now I'm probably going to get the terminology wrong, but like they have like block producer and you know block validator or something, and the idea is that if you kind of have insight into this block and the next block, maybe you can do something to kind of give yourself more of it and front run the actual guy trying to do the trade on the supposedly decentralized exchange, right? That's kind of the idea. And I guess to what you're saying, Bitcoin has a different model. It wouldn't be built in this way of having like such a large liquidity pool on Bitcoin. Although you could argue that also exists on like Liquid, like the Fuji money guys, right?
Yeah, so on Liquid you have like a what's it called, automated market maker. I think it's called Matrix or something. Yeah. So the Matrix guys, they built an automated market maker, BitMatrix, using the covenants constructions that we have on Liquid. So you could argue that MEV could arise there, even though, even when you have covenants, you with Bitcoin, you still can always commit to the last transaction. Practically, it might mean you might have to like make a whole bunch of transactions because every time a modern trader makes a trade, you need to like...
You need to respond. Pull,
yeah.
Like a lightning justice.
Yeah, no, not respond, but it's like, if you want to be the next trade in, you need to know the previous trade. So you need to like make a whole bunch of different transactions where you're always the next trade. But then at least you always have the certainty, like, I'm committing to this price and I will get this price. While in Ethereum, if someone makes a transaction right before yours, you get a different price.
So then, but then I guess that is the question, right? So if certain soft forks are enabled that enable this kind of MEV, like, do you think that's a legitimate concern? Like, you know, should people be wary of that? Of like, what exactly are we turning on here?
You always opt into an application, right? It's true to say with MEV that if other people opt into applications that might enable MEV, you give an incentive to the miners to behave irrationally or badly.
Centralize.
Yeah, you centralize, and it might also give you a disadvantage. But I think if we can provide tools for people to create tools that, like applications that don't have MEV, like I think personally, many of the Ethereum applications that have MEV could be made a bit more advanced to like reduce a lot of the MEV. And I think if we just provide, in our framework, make it easier to write your applications in an MEV like resistant way somehow, that we can actually like, that most developers will not make their app vulnerable to MEV if it's easier to like make it MEV proof. It can happen. It can happen. Yeah. And if it happens and it like becomes a really big thing and suddenly MEV is like a problem, sure.
Yeah. So as an example, as I understand, certain types of soft forks, like a CTV as an example, where you sort of have to pre-compute out the possibilities or the exit pathways, let's say, or as I understand, TX hash in the basic format and not kind of an expanded version of TX hash, you could make it so that you're sort of restricting those pathways so that, again, you're sort of trying to stop the possibility of MEV, right? So I guess that might be one way people choose to go, but I think there'll be, let's say, a lot of people who are saying, let's focus on what we can do now before we sort of have to do soft fork stuff. Like maybe there's low-hanging fruit. Maybe there's more we can do to get Lightning improved.
Well, one thing I want to add on MEV, sorry to go back to the topic, is that MEV sucks for the user, right? Because it's literally miners extracting value from other users, from like the other participants in the network. So if you can make your application to not have MEV or to not allow for MEV or to be like more protected from MEV, users are going to want that. So like if it's easier to make your application MEV protected, users want those applications. So like then I don't think it's going to be a risk. As long as like you make it possible and easy to MEV proof your applications.
So in your framing, it's more about MEV proofing as opposed to, but I guess the main concern people would have is maybe like unintended consequences, right? And the same, obviously, the spam, the ordinals, and all this, to be clear, BRC20 and stamps. I think that's maybe what people are worried about. Like if you turn something on, is someone later down the line going to find a way to sort of do something that is, put it this way, a negative externality, right? Like, so the users didn't choose it, but they're now kind of stuck with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a risk, right? There's going to be a risk with everything. There's also like negative externalities that we already have today, but we didn't find out yet. I mean, any change has, many changes have repercussions in many different areas, and we might not foresee them all. I think that's why in Bitcoin we're very like conservative. We propose changes, we reason about them for a long time, we try out some applications, we try out like what we can do with this. And people have come up with like problems for many different things that are proposed. I think CTV specifically is really so constrained that like it's not gonna open doors for MEV, it's not gonna like have unforeseen risks. Because it's been around for almost about 5 years, 4 years,
yeah. Like,
and people have been thinking about it. There's been a whole lot of use cases laid out. There's even a testnet for like already two years or something running with CTV. I think CTV specifically, we're gonna be really safe. If we're gonna like look at things like simplicity, maybe TX hash, maybe OptX, maybe like really more broad stuff. Yeah, we have to like go back to the like, okay, what can we do with this that is not like gotcha. Something that we want. Then we need like the really adversarial thinkers, the audible thinkers yeah. to like, okay, try and break this. Like, please try and yeah. extract value using the tools that we have. But I think CTV is definitely not in that category.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's fair to say. So let's finish up with this. Obviously, I know you're interested in ARC. You're researching and working on ARC stuff. Give us the latest there. As I understand, it is obviously a more complex environment. You know, it's going to take some work to build it out and make it safe for people. Can you just give us kind of a broad, you know, few minutes on where ARC is at and where you think the progress can be made?
Sorry, I had to swallow, but
okay,
I don't have
yeah.
water.
All good.
I think like on the panel yesterday, Peter Tau was saying something like ARC is really complicated, but I think he was talking about Lightning on ARC, right? But because I think ARC as a protocol is so much easier than Lightning. It's like not peer-to-peer. It's not like... Like with Lightning, you interface with your peers, but that peer is interfacing with another peer, and like you have
right.
to like have
and
like
you have to think about liquidity across the route.
Yeah, you have to like look at all this routing, like a lot of unknowns in the protocol that you always have to like think about. And the peer to peer also makes for like feature negotiation. What if like his peers don't have the features that I have in my peer? And ARC is client server. Like there's one coordinator, and then a whole bunch of users only talking with that coordinator. Maybe on the edges they might like exchange a few messages, but like. The protocol itself is so much easier because you have one coordinator doing all the heavy lifting, doing like all the constructing the transactions, combining all the payments together, and then the edges, the users only validate that what the ASP did is legit, and they have some emergency code for if the ASP does bad stuff, then they can like react. But other than that, they don't have that much crazy things to do, like
yeah.
Okay. Like with Lightning, like there's a whole lot of like random yeah. externalities.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me just because we've gone through a lot there, so let me just try and put it in simple terms. You tell me if I've got it correct. So the idea with ARC is you have a VTXO. Like if you're just a regular user, you might have your ARC app as an example, and you have an ASP, an ARC service provider instead of like an LSP, Lightning service provider. You have these VTXOs. They give you the possibility, as we said, of unilateral exit. But obviously, the optimistic case is you stay off chain and you stay in the VTXO concept. But as you said, you are kind of working with your ASP and they kind of give you this VTXO that you have the unilateral ability to exit out if you need to. And so we trade around with these VTXOs and I guess as Barack says, you can kind of onboard people without having to think about inbound liquidity and all of these other aspects because the ASP, you're offloading those concerns to the ASP, but there's maybe some additional complexity at the scripting, I guess, because and this is where ideally something like CTV would enable this and also arguably help enable other L2 concepts on top of Bitcoin. Fair summary?
Yeah, that's a good summary. It's worth to note that we can build ARC and we have built a proof of concept of ARC without any soft forks needed. So it's based on music. It has a bunch more interactions between the people participating in the rounds, but you can do ARC. ARC is basically based on pre-made transactions. Right, and as we know with Lightning, we also have pre-made transactions, and we call them pre-signed transactions because you pre-sign them. And what's all that CTV does is remove the need for signing for pre-signed transactions, and then they can actually become pre-made or pre-committed transactions. And then any person can just pre-calculate all these transactions and like put them on the chain instead of having to create them and then have a bunch of people like also sign them, right? So you just have to talk with various people and you can do it all by yourself. So that's why CTV is obviously gonna be like really useful for ARC, but we can build something that I think is fairly useful and like definitely also like revolutionary and new without needing CTV for now.
Gotcha. Interesting. Okay. So, yeah, because that was another question that people were having is, would it need CTV to happen on mainnet or otherwise people are gonna have to use Liquid and do it as a arc on Liquid. So what are you guys thinking in terms of doing it on Liquid versus going for a mainnet deployment, let's say?
So we're still very early stages. We actually have a proof of concept in both scenarios. So we have a proof of concept on Liquid that is using the covenants that Liquid has. And that, interestingly, like you can build an arc with any of the Liquid assets because Liquid has assets natively. So you could do a Tether arc, you could do a UZC arc, Bitcoin arc, obviously. And then we have another proof of concept on mainnet. I mean, it's running on Cygnet, but it doesn't use any of the Cygnet specific features. So it could be run on mainnet. That is not using covenants, that is using pre-signed transactions. And we're still thinking about which way we want to go, which one of the two versions we want to focus on. That's going to be for the next few months.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, great. Thanks for the updates. This is Stephen Roosk, and I'll put Stephen's links in the description. Thanks, Stephen.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Here we are. I'm here with Peter Todd. We're going to talk a little bit about a bunch of things, but let's just start with, I think you're working on this Libra Relay stuff. So I think this will be an interesting one to explain for people because it's kind of like a whole new thing. What is Libra Relay?
Well, it's a couple things at once, but the initial start of it was some people who thought it was kind of silly that Bitcoin Core still limited op return size, the number of op return outputs in transactions according to the standardness rules. And Christopher Allen was the first person who thought this kind of silly and paid me to do a pull request to go and try to change this Bitcoin Core. Of course, sure enough, that was rejected. So some other people then paid me yet more money, you know, to do a few more hours work to go and create a fork of Bitcoin Core that A, would remove those restrictions from the standardist rules, and B, would peer to other Libra Relay nodes. And the way that works is Libra Relay nodes advertise a service bit, and in the Bitcoin peer-to-peer network, service bits kind of say, well, what services do you offer? You know, one service example being, well, I offer the service of giving you old archival blocks. You know, that's a node network. Other ones, you know, the service of like SegWit, right? Well, Libra Relay offers a service of less restrictive mempool rules, and each Libra Relay node connects to four other Libra Relay nodes, and thus transactions can go broadcast around.
So let's just quickly explain one thing. So just to make sure people can follow along, there's this difference between policy and consensus, right? So think of it like this. Bitcoin Core will relay transactions that it sees within its policy, but that is distinct from what is consensus valid. So as an example, there are certain transaction types, as you're getting at, Peter, that are valid at the consensus level, but not valid at the default policy level, let's say, right?
So do you want to explain that?
Yeah. Well, so I think the defendable reason why you would have policy limits is mainly around upgrades. So as an example, when Bitcoin version, you know, whatever zero came out, the transaction version number was set to one, all right? Transaction version one. And we went and did a soft fork that, among other things, created transaction version two that redefined how the end sequence field worked to, long story short, let you do things important to Lightning. Well, policy of Bitcoin Core prior to that soft fork was that while transaction version numbers are allowed to be anything, invalid blocks, because they didn't have any meaning associated with them, we wouldn't relay transactions with versions greater than one, because we don't know what they do, right? Maybe there's an upgrade. Well, sure enough, there is an upgrade, and now transaction version two is fairly common. And the important thing is that if you were a Bitcoin Core node doing mining, you would continue to create valid blocks because you would not accept these new transactions that you don't know what they are into your mempool and thus into your blocks.
Yeah. So just a quick one on that. So people might have the concern, and might be a legitimate concern, that there are certain types of specially crafted transactions that could crash your node or, you know, something like that. So do you want to just explain a bit around that? Is it like, I guess the question is there not a valid reason for that? Maybe because you don't want this kind of DDoSing or this kind of taking down someone's node aspect?
Well, that's another valid technical reason why transaction policy limits exist. So there are, with version one scripting, right, the script system that Bitcoin was originally released with, that scripting system has a bunch of flaws in it. And long story short is you can go create transactions that, while they won't actually crash your node, they will take a very long time to validate. And again, if you're a miner and you accept these into your mempool and thus into your blocks, you could create a block that could take minutes to validate. Now, I could go on for 30 minutes about the game theory of this, but long story short, for a lot of miners, that means your block is not going to propagate fast enough to get built on, and you just lost a lot of money.
Right, it's very uncompetitive.
Yes, extremely uncompetitive. You do not want those transactions in your blocks. Frankly, at some point we should do a soft fork to go fix these edge cases.
Right. But and just on that, is that an example there would be Matt Corella's Great Consensus soft fork cleanup or something in that vein?
Exactly, yeah. That would be one of the goals of that particular proposal, and you know, I agree, it should get fixed at some point. It's just, it hasn't been high on the priority list, because when you get down to it, in most cases, this is just people shooting themselves in the foot, right? It's not actually an attack against other miners outside of certain cases with game theory and all that. But again, that's like 30-minute talk.
Yeah, gotcha.
But, you know, the long story short is most of these rules exist for a reason. However, the op return limit is not one of those rules. There is no technical reason why op return should be limited. It's just a piece of data. Now, you can make sort of economic, social, spam, whatever arguments, but that's not a technical concern. A Bitcoin transaction with 1,000 op returns validates just fine. It relays just fine. There is no impact directly at a technical level. Thus, Libra Relay removed that rule. And the funny thing about this is, you know, for all this discussion we've had about spam on the blockchain and so on, my view on this has been the response to it is worse than the problem.
Okay.
You know, all of our like social media drama, all of the, you know, people trying to go and like block this stuff, et cetera, all of this is just so much more harmful than just ignoring it and allowing fees to go handle the problem. If people want to do transactions, they have to go pay fees for it. Simple as that. So I created, you know, one of the reasons why I was willing to create Libra Relay was because I figured, look, the op return thing is obviously silly. Bitcoin Core shouldn't do that. It's only, you know, there's one or two other things which could Libra Relay could do, but for most part, it's only like silly bit of paternalism. But by releasing Libra Relay, what I'm doing is I'm telling Bitcoin Core, don't go and add yet more silly restrictions, because it's just going to get routed around. Right.
So let's just talk about that for a second. Like, I can imagine, obviously, I won't be able to fully represent the view because I don't understand it as well. But let's say you were talking to Luke Dasher or someone like that, or Bitcoin Mechanic. They might say to you, well, look, we can filter some of this spam with bare multisig equals zero, or some of the discussion around data carrier size, they would want to filter that spam out, because they would say, look, Bitcoin is a monetary network. What would you say to that?
Well, the fact is, what they are trying to do is, from a technical point of view, censorship. And it's very easy to write around censorship because data is easy to spread and hard to stifle. And Libra Relay is an example of this. It is so easy for people to just bypass mempool filtering by sending transactions directly to miners or using something like Libra Relay. And the problem we have is the sending transactions directly to miners version of this can be really harmful, because it means big miners can make more money than small ones. You know, and I don't mean like more money in general. I mean more money per unit hash.
Okay. So this is like a mining centralization concern. It's basically the kind of the argument you're making.
That's exactly it. And you know, I don't want to fearmonger here. At the moment, this isn't a very big concern, but the time to stop the silliness is now. Okay. You know, to not go further down this path of creating yet more problems. And you know, this is a funny thing about Libra Relay. Like, all it does from the point of view of filtering is change one thing. Now, I'm also doing something else with Libra Relay, which I think is a discussion we can also have.
Okay.
But
so,
from filtering point of view, it doesn't do very much. It's more like a demo to say, hey, filtering this stuff is out is silly. Look, Libra Relay actually works. You can actually broadcast transactions with more than one op return or a really big op return. It will get mined.
Okay. But let's just cover one other area, because for the sake of, you know, steel manning the filter raw view.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say the filter raw is thinking, look, I understand it's not going to filter out all the spam, but if we can at least reduce the spam and sort of keep the purpose of Bitcoin being about monetary transactions as opposed to arbitrary file storage, what would you say to that view?
Well, my response is very simple. They're not in a position where they can even make, you know, meaningfully change this at all. It's not like they can even stop a little bit of it. The fact is, the people who want to go use Bitcoin for these purposes, it is so easy for them to route around filtering nodes that it's just not worth having the discussion. Like, yes, maybe you could make a better argument if the filters actually worked, but they don't. They just create noise, they create problems, and I just don't think Bitcoin Core should waste effort on this kind of nonsense. It's just not worth the dev time looking at these patches to filter yet another version of stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave that there. Let's talk a little bit about this other topic you mentioned earlier, which is around RBFR, replaced by fee relay, because I'm a bit confused.
Replaced by fee rate.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes.
Sorry. Can you explain that?
Okay. So, completely unrelated filtering, basically. Things like Lightning, where multiple parties at once are authoring a transaction, have a problem called transaction pinning. And basically, you know, you can imagine a Lightning channel where you need to go on chain, you have a commitment transaction, and you want that commitment transaction to get mined. Because, you know, there's a time window when it really needs to get mined. And I'm going to intentionally oversimplify it, so, you know, bear with me here if you actually know how this works. But roughly speaking, if you and I have that channel, I could try to go screw you over by preventing your commitment transaction from getting mined.
The idea is you could, like, pin my transaction to the bottom of the mempool such that I have to pay this uneconomical amount to kind of get my money back.
And, you know, when you get down to, of course, the way we kind of think it works is, obviously, if you want to get the transaction mined soon, faster, you pay a higher fee. All right, that's how you would expect. It might be a fairly high fee, but at least you can do this in a reasonable amount of money. But with transaction pinning, it allows me, the bad guy, to create transactions that either directly conflict with the one you need to get mined or maybe spend one of the outputs. But long story short is, while they may be very big, they may pay a very high fee in total, the fee rate is very small. So if the fee rate is very small, well, when will this transaction get mined? I mean, maybe never. Like, it might be a fee rate so small that that fee rate just is never high enough to get mined. So while I put up a bunch of money in fee, the transaction doesn't get mined, and you eventually get screwed over. Now, replaced by fee rate says, basically, well, why don't we look at the fee rate of transactions when we decide whether we replace one with the another? So with replaced by fee rate, well, I can broadcast this really low fee rate transaction that's really big, you can outbid it with a higher fee rate transaction, which is more desirable to miners because they'll be able to mine it immediately rather than, like, wait, you know, 6 months if forever.
Okay. One other point that I'm not fully understanding yet, but is this sort of like a competing idea to, like, V3 transactions and this idea of, as I understand it, as Gloria explained it to me, it's like, you sort of restrain, it's like an opt-in type of transaction that, let's say, restricts, you know, it's like one parent, one child, and certain rules that are like an alternate way in, let's say, her or their view to stop pinning, let's say, or stop some but not all pinning vectors.
Yeah. So, and again, I'll have to oversimplify a little, but basically what V3 transactions is, it said, well, why don't we add a new set of sort of mempool filtering rules, which expands the validity of, like, what we'll allow into mempool a little bit by saying version 3 transactions are now allowed in the mempool. But the rules we assign to them are very restrictive. They say, well, they can only be re-spent in certain ways. Now, it's consensus valid to spend them in all kinds of ways, but the V3 transactions tries to create a system where the ways that you do certain types of transaction pinning, but not others, just can't be done in mempool standardness. And my response to basically the whole line of argument is, the fact is, we've seen that V3 transactions are kind of weak. They don't really solve this problem fully. There's a lot of cases where they just don't solve it at all. One example being HTLC transactions. They just, you know, it just isn't targeted at that problem, and it's still a problem. And whereas replaced by fee rate, it looks at perspective of miner incentives. It says, well, how do we align what miners want to happen and what the transaction contracting system wants to happen, you know? Well, fortunately, they are aligned. Miners want to mine high fee rate transactions. If we allow high fee rate transactions to broadcast around the network and enter into miners' mempools and enter into their blocks, this solves the problem naturally. We just need to find a way of implementing this. And fortunately, with Libra Relay, because I have this sort of new set of Bitcoin nodes, new set of, like, Bitcoin Core version that relays these transactions, I can experiment with new rules. So Libra Relay does enable, replaced by fee rate, a particular simple version of this, where if the fee rate is double, or if the fee rate of the replacement is double the highest fee rate of the transactions it replaces, it is allowed in. Now, there are certain cases where, you know, maybe that isn't quite incentive optimal. I mean, maybe, you know, someone sent a 100 sat per VByte transaction that's also really big, and like replacing it with 200 sat that's smaller. In that case, the miner might actually be earning less money. But implementing all that stuff is quite challenging for a bunch of technical reasons. And those sort of edge cases are just so rare. It's perfectly fine to experiment with something simple at first, see how it works, see what kind of replace by fee rate replacements happen, and go from there. And that's my strategy. Now, there are more complex versions of this idea, which I think future changes Bitcoin Core will enable, because we'll be able to do things like quickly query, well, what is the top, say, 1 megabyte worth of mempool, right? What transactions will get into the next block at this moment? And you can modify the replace by fee rate rules to take into that kind of economics. But as a simple prototype to get something out of the door, Libra Relay has a nice simple way to do it. And the beauty of the sort of 2x rule is if you double fee rate every time, sort of like, the standard, the chess thing, right? The grain of rice on the first chess and you double it each time. Well, doubling each time gets big really quickly. So the number of possible replacements that could happen, and thus the amount of bandwidth used, is always reasonably limited.
Quick question, and now I'm not sure if I'm fully understanding all the intricacies of this, because I'm just learning it now. Yeah. But as an example, if you got a Lightning channel with many pending HTLCs on it, you would still have a lot of inputs on that transaction. Does that, or are you saying it's double in total?
Well, so the fee rate thing, it's saying the fee rate has to be double each time. Now, in your example where, you're trying to close a channel with a ton of HTLCs pending, in that example, for me to go pin it, I would just have to go broadcast basically an even bigger transaction. And I could still pin that. But the main thing is that while that transaction, while your Lightning close may be expensive because all these HTLCs pending, at least with replaced by fee rate, it's not outrageously more expensive to outbid, right? Like you might be bidding, say, 10 sats per VByte, right? Like say if that's optimal, I could go and pin it with 1 sat per VByte transaction that's still, 100 times bigger. You would have to go pay a much bigger, much more money, like sort of the full 100 times, if you will, to replace it under current replaced by fee rules. With replaced by fee rate, you just have to pay whatever the minimum ratio to get over that threshold. And with the very simple version I've done, it would be 2x. So you might pay 20 sat per VByte.
Okay, so I guess your argument is it's still bad, but it's, let's say, less bad.
Yeah, and I should say, I should point out, the 2x thing, that's just a number I picked just to have a very safe default. I think a reasonable real production default would be 1.25. So you might pay 25% more than you wanted, or maybe 10% more or something. But For the prototype, just to be safe, I picked a higher number because that directly controls how much money does an attacker spend to broadcast data on the network.
Gotcha. All right, and so I guess let's zoom out a little bit more and just kind of looking at Bitcoin and Lightning and some of these ideas. People are talking about soft fork ideas, but I guess there's a lot of debate on that and whether that's even necessary at this stage. I'm curious where you sort of land on any of these ideas. Is that unnecessary, or is it more like have a chat about them and sort of talk about what trade-offs we want?
Yeah, I think one of the issues that we have in terms of getting new soft forks in is there's such a big design space of these things. You look at Check Template Verify as an example. For the things people advocate it being good for, there's a whole bunch of other possible ways to go do stuff that have pluses and minuses. And, without even trying to go talk about the specific pluses and minuses, it has been hard to come to some kind of consensus over, do we really need this? Is it actually good enough for use cases? Now, if we go backwards a bit, I proposed a soft fork that is now in Bitcoin, Check Lock Time Verify. What I proposed, we knew at the time it would definitely be used for payment channels. And indeed, Lightning channels do use Check Lock Time Verify. It didn't happen quite the way we foresaw, but it was pretty close, and we guessed right. This is important. Basically, all Bitcoin users are going to need it. Frankly, I look around at this conference, and you probably got, 4,000, 5,000 people buying, their coffees with Lightning. Every single one of those people is ultimately using Check Lock Time Verify. And, in terms of, number of people who actually use Bitcoin, it would not be surprising if 50% of them had made use of this feature at some point because of the use of Lightning. Does OpVault have that same kind of argument? How many people actually need that niche Vault thing in a particular way? And, the arguments become a lot harder to make. Yeah. And this is, this is challenging.
On this point, let's just talk about that, because with CTV, I guess the CTV proponent could argue, look, a lot of people kind of keep butting back into using something like CTV. There's even TXHash, which could be argued is like an extension of that idea, that maybe they would argue we need this CTV primitive somewhere, somehow. What do you think about that?
Well, if that was a good argument, it would be much easier to go show examples of people actually using this in prototypes, as well as in production and sort of simulated CTV, and we haven't really seen it that much. And the nuances of exactly like what's the right trade-off, there hasn't been much consensus. Also, sort of more technical issue, CTV invites child pays for parent constructions, where you pay the fees by having a separate transaction. And of course, having two transactions rather than one is inefficient, which would be okay if that was all it was. But the real problem is that if I have a protocol that requires two transactions, but one of them is purely to pay fees, I can save money by just giving the first transaction directly to a miner at a band.
Right. So coming back to mining centralization arguments here.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, out-of-band payments are very scary because they have the potential to make mining extremely centralized if constructs that need this catch on. And we did see this as fees went up. A lot of Lightning Channel closes actually wound up happening through out-of-band payments. I mean, I personally made a couple of them, in part because, of course, my job is to experiment with everything.
Right.
But so I went through and, hey, I have this use case.
Yeah.
Does it work? Well, it does. And as that becomes easier, it becomes harder and harder for more decentralized miners to go make a profit.
Interesting. But I guess that perhaps that could also be balanced by people saying, look, the idea is that we use these protocols, and the idea is that you, for example, with Lightning, that you don't need to do a justice transaction, that you're trying to build for, the idea is that there's a happy path where there's less on-chain interaction, and so the idea is that you would use the unhappy path less. It's kind of I guess that would be a steel man, right?
Well, that's the idea, but there are a lot of lightning force closes out there. That's just the reality of this. And also, the fact that there is this potential economic incentive does mean that it's possible for bad actors to go and trigger this stuff deliberately to earn money. It also, it speaks to what are the limits of Lightning? Because, when you get down to how many people can use Lightning, those limits are really driven by how many force closes can you do in one block? How quickly can we get people's money back if something doesn't work out? And relying on constructs, which are twice as big as necessary, means that your ultimate capacity in these situations is half as much. That's just not good engineering. And unfortunately, child pays for parents is an easy way to do things, but I think as Lightning implementations progress, I certainly hope that will go away so that we get more scale out of Lightning.
I see. As I understand, there's maybe a related debate around if fees are inlined or it's kind of like using anchor outputs as an approach. I think that's kind of a related debate, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, I should say it is basically the same debate, because anchor outputs are an example of child pays for parent. An example, like the idea behind V3 is basically, well, you would tend to go use purely anchor outputs, and your V3 transaction would be the first one. And then because of the V3 rules, it would be safe to spend that transaction's anchor output and then add the fees there. But of course, now you're designing a design where in a lot of cases, you basically use twice as much block space when you could have used a lot less, but paid for out-of-band mining.
Interesting. Okay, well, yeah, we've gone through a lot of stuff here, but really appreciate you sharing your insights. Guys, make sure you follow Peter and check him out. I'll put all the links in the, in the description below. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure to check out the show notes at StefanLivera.com. I have a newsletter now as well, StefanLivera.substack.com. That's it for me, and I'll see you in the Citadels.